Hello and thanks for joining us. You're listening to Season 1, Episode 14 of Mysterious Universe Plus. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Sitting next to me is Aaron Wright, looking a bit bleary-eyed after your party last night.
Well, it wasn't exactly a party. It was a Lady Gaga concert. It was so awesome.
You got surprised with tickets, didn't you?
I did. And I was like, oh my God, how did you get tickets to this sold-out concert? It was so much fun. Like, I wasn't really a big Lady Gaga fan before. I mean, I liked her stuff, but I was never really keen on her. And this concert was just amazing. Like, there's very much a sort of a crypto theme to it as well.
Yeah, the album's, it's the Monsters Ball Tour, isn't it?
That's right.
So
yeah.
There's monsters, right?
There's monsters. Like, this giant monster comes out and it's sort of, she's killing it, and then they're just doing amazing stuff. Like, she really is a great entertainer. I strongly recommend, if she's coming to your city, go and check her out. She's just brilliant.
Cool. So how are your ears?
Yeah, that's not so good.
You got to look after your ears, man. You're doing a radio show.
Yeah, I know. I know. My ears actually were ringing. Like, I got into bed last night. I'm like, what is that noise? I thought I'd left the oven on. I'm like, oh, it's a ring in my ears. That's not so good. And then this Sunday night, I'm going to the Imogen Heap concert.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm going to be deaf. At least I can speak.
Well, your ears are damaged and my nose is hell today.
Oh, what is with you at the moment?
Just,
it's really bad.
Allergies are so bad today. I'm struggling over here.
But describe to our listeners how you're going to solve the problem, because this is just gross.
It's funny because a listener actually recommended this years ago in season one, because I occasionally suffer from allergies. And they said, why don't you try a neti pot? I was like, what on earth is a neti pot? So I Googled it and discovered this horrible instructional video. It's this Indian remedy where you fill this little pot with a little spout on the end. You fill it with a salt water solution and you pour it in through one nostril. The solution travels through your sinuses and it comes out the other nostril.
Ew.
And it clears it out.
So you'll be doing that outside. Well, tell our listeners what your wife did to the last one.
Well, she just threw it out.
Right.
She thought it was so disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is actually really gross if you see the demonstration videos, but it worked.
That's the thing. Sure, though?
It worked. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't particularly pleasant, but it was the only thing that worked.
But that reminds me of ear candles. Have you ever had an ear candle?
Never had an ear candle. No, I've heard about them.
I have.
Never
had one. Being the person I am, I couldn't help but cut it open and see what was inside it. And it's not wax. It's like a white powdery substance. So I've got no idea what, I mean, it might be something from the ear canal, but God knows what it is.
Well, I ordered one today. I ordered a neti pot today. So we'll see on next week's episode if it helps out.
Yeah, it might meet an unfortunate accident with a hammer.
We've got a great show lined up. It's funny because St. Patrick's Day just passed recently. And on St. Patrick's Day, no new Plus subscribers and no web traffic. What were you guys doing on St. Patrick's Day?
I think all of our listeners are drunks.
Possible. It's definitely possible.
That's pretty cool, though. I approve of that. So don't worry.
Right. So we've got a story on the history of St. Patrick's Day, and it actually links to ancient Egypt. That's coming up first, but later on in the show, some incredible new sightings from Chile following the earthquake.
Yeah, this is weird.
Including UFOs and entities. We also return to mummies. We've got some ancient Chinese mummies that are making their way to the States for the first time. And also a new Harlequin story from Jason Offit, who will be joining us on next week's episode as well. First up, let's look at the secret history of St. Patrick's Day. This is from the blog secretsun.blogspot.com. And the blogger writes, March 17th is the day generally believed to be the death of St. Patrick, the British-born missionary, who is credited with converting Ireland to Christianity.
Yeah, didn't that go well?
Yeah, but like all our modern Christian holidays, celebrations, festivals, they've all got pagan roots.
Yes, they do.
Mm. And some are even further back to Egyptian religions.
But we don't celebrate St. Patrick's Day here, really, do we?
No, it's really become an American thing, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's huge in America. I remember I was over there at one stage when it was St. Patrick's Day, and it was just huge. I mean, it was great. The festive atmosphere was brilliant.
Mm, but the roots are interesting. He says, in Egyptian mythology, Osiris was killed on the 17th day of Athia, the third month of the ancient calendar. The 17th of the third month is also the date of a Masonically created holiday, St. Patrick's Day. The story has it that the holiday was established by high-level Freemason George Washington, allegedly to reward Irish soldiers in the Continental Army. But St. Paddy's has traditionally been a very minor saint's day in Ireland. Considering that the day has become America's de facto bacchanal, it's worth noting some of the parallels of this day with solar mythology. So then he's got a list of some of these links here. Osiris was believed to be the source of barley, which was used for brewing beer in Egypt. It's also customary to wear green on St. Patrick's Day, obviously. And Osiris was known as the Green Man. And the root word of Patrick is pater, which is the Latin word meaning father. And of course, Osiris is the father in the Egyptian Trinity.
Yeah, this is really interesting to me, Ben. There's so many connections here to the ancient Egyptians and to the Freemasons. I mean, it will stir up some of those rumors that Freemasons run the United States.
Oh, that's a whole other topic.
But we're going to go there. It says here, this is quite shocking, that St. Patrick's Day was originally celebrated by Protestant loyalists in the British Army. It says their first meeting and dinner to honor St. Patrick was an expression of their Protestant faith, as well as their intention to bond with fellow Irish immigrants. Their 1775 meeting included British soldiers of Irish extraction, all proceeded on march to the King's Chapel to hear a sermon devoted to the occasion, and then continued to a dinner in King Street. British soldiers were still the big show of the first St. Patrick's Day, which occurred in New York City in 1762.
Yeah, so then later he says that General George Washington issued a proclamation during the Revolutionary War declaring March 17, 1780, a holiday for the Continental Army in honour of the many soldiers of Irish ancestry and those born in Ireland.
So as we were saying before about the fact that we don't really celebrate St. Patrick's Day here in Australia, Ben, apparently up until very recently, St. Patrick's Day was not a big deal in Ireland either.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because St. Patrick's Day is about drinking, right? Let's just lay it out there. It's about getting drunk, right?
It's about writing yourself off,
right,
while you're wearing something green.
But up until the 1970s, it was illegal for pubs to be opened in Ireland on St. Patrick's Day.
Isn't that amazing?
What an amazing contrast.
But it says here, beginning in 1995, the Irish government began a national campaign to use St. Patrick's Day as an opportunity to drive tourism and showcase Ireland to the rest of the world. So they've taken a holiday and they've grasped it to make tourism out of it and some domestic product for it. Now, St. Patrick's Day, as you say, Ben, is frequently a time for drinking. It used to be that the tradition was strung out for at least 5 days. Now, this was actually called Irish Week. Now, this may stem from the Roman times when March 17 started the Festival of Bacchanalia, a celebration of the deity Bacchus, to whom wine was sacred. In olden years long ago, the Irish drank mead, which was made from fermented honey.
So you mentioned the links to the Roman god Bacchus there, but he goes on to point out that Bacchus is, of course, just a copy from, it's just a reinterpretation of Osiris.
Right.
And drinking beer was, in fact, sacred to the followers of Osiris as well, the Green Man. He says in Egypt, beer was regarded as food. In fact, the old Egyptian hieroglyph for meal was a compound of those for bread and beer. This bread, beer, meal, plus a few onions and some dried fish was the standard diet of the common people along the Nile at the time.
Geez, no wonder they had so many health problems.
All they're doing is drinking beer.
Yeah.
Beer came in 8 different types in Egypt. Most were made from barley, some from emma, and many were flavoured with ginger or honey. The best beers were brewed to a colour as red as human blood. The Egyptians distinguished between the different beers by their alcoholic strength and dominant flavour. None other than the god of the dead, Osiris, was hailed as the guardian of beer, because to him, grain, both emmer and barley, were sacred. The Egyptians believed that grain had sprung spontaneously from Osiris's mummy as a gift to mankind and as a symbol of life after death.
Here's a little side fact for you, Ben. Did you know that beer actually contains serotonin?
Really?
Yeah. So this is why when you drink beer, even though it's a central nervous system depressant, people get that euphoric and relaxing sort of feeling from it because it actually contains serotonin.
Right.
So the writer of this article finishes off by saying, "So it's official. All of our modern holidays in America are simply covert repackagings of ancient pagan festivals, and the increasingly popular St. Patrick's Day is no different." It's interesting, though, because it's not just America. There's so many countries around the world which we have these festivals and times of celebration which have come from ancient times.
It all comes from the old world and it's always converted from something even older than that.
That's right. It reminds me of that video we played quite a while ago. I think it was back in season 2 where they were celebrating a pagan festival. And these people that were celebrating this festival said, "Oh, much of it comes from our ancient text and the rest of it we just make up on the way."
Right, that sounds sacred indeed. Next, we move to cryptomundo.com. I thought this linked in nicely. It's a guest post by Paul Burns on a famous Irish cryptid. It's known as the Dob Hartshoe, and Burns writes, "Nobody wants to meet a pooka. More often than not, this animal spirit is malevolent and is to be avoided. The pooka usually appears as a horse, though it can take the form of almost any animal, Several of my friends who are not well versed in Irish ways have named pets Pooka, and frankly, I'm cautious around them. There are other animal spirits sometimes confused with the Pooka. One is the water horse, and the other, an especially evil variety, is called the Dobhartu, or water dog. A recent social history called Echoes of a Savage Land by historian Joe McGowan recounts that September the 22nd, 1722, Grace Connolly went from her home to nearby Glencade Lake to bathe. When she did not return, her husband went to search for her and was horrified to find Grace's mangled body on the lake shore with a sated water fiend, the Dobhartu. It was lying asleep among the scattered remains. McLaughlin slew the beast, but immediately another of that fearsome species sprang from the lake and attacked him. McLaughlin and his brother fled on horseback, pursued for miles by the demon, but upon reaching Cashelgarran, the horses gave out. The brothers placed their horses across the entrance to that ancient fort and prepared to fight for their lives. The Dobhartu charged at them with such violence that it thrust its head and forepart completely through one of the horses, and McLaughlin buried his dagger in its heart. Grace Connolly's tombstone in Conwell Cemetery has on it a carving of a strange beast being stabbed by a dagger. Cashelgarran's stone fort still stands, and both monster and horse are buried nearby. Bathers are seldom seen in Glencade Lake anymore.
It's interesting how folklore can continue to influence people even now.
What would be a explanation for this? I mean, the image they've got here looks like some weird kind of otter. But what kind of otter thrusts itself through a horse's body, you know, and can kill a man?
Well, it's interesting that you should mention an otter, Ben, because in this book I have, which is the Encyclopedia of Magical Creatures written by John and Caitlin Matthews, it says the Dobhartu is the name of the father of all otters in Ireland. The Dobhartu is so powerful that it can break through rocks and tunnels at incredible speeds beneath the earth. It is of great size, being about 6 to 8 feet from head to tail, with short white fur and a dark brown cross marking its back. The otter was a sacred animal among the Celts, probably because it was equally at home on land or in the water. The margins of watery places were considered as gateways to the other world. The Dobhartu, also known as the Dorahow, is sometimes called the King of the Lakes. The native people of Ireland describe him as both ferocious and terrifying. However, they held him in the highest respect. So I don't know what that could be, Ben.
So he's the king of the otters.
He's king of the otters.
Maybe it's not easy to kill an otter.
But I love otters. Have you seen an otter up close?
They're cute.
They're so cute.
They've got a cute face.
They lie on their back in the water.
Yeah.
And they hold their food. Like, I saw them at SeaWorld in San Diego, and they're so cute. I would have stolen one and taken it back with me if I had the chance. And on that note, on me plotting to steal wildlife, we're going to take a quick music break. When we come back, we're going to discuss some interesting new data that's come from the moon. Listening to Mysterious Universe Plus.
Next, we move to the Planetary Society's blog with a very excited Emily Lakdawalla. She's blogging about the Bonanza Day for the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. The first formal release of orbit data happened this morning. This was published on March the 15th, including 10 terabytes of camera data. Have fun going through all that. But she said, I absolutely could not let the images pass without posting them straight away. Photos of Soviet hardware on the surface of the moon has been revealed, namely the sample return missions from Luna 20, Luna 23 and Luna 24, plus a preview of the Lunokhod 2 rover's 37 kilometres of tracks across the moon's surface. These are pretty interesting because we saw photos a few months back revealing some of NASA's hardware left on the moon, and I think there was even footprints from the landing site on one of the Apollo missions. Did you remember seeing those images?
Yes, I do. Yeah, it was really interesting.
It is really cool stuff. And obviously, the Russian hardware that you can see in the images is quite small. I mean, it's only maybe 20 pixels wide. But still, it's so amazing that this stuff is still there and we're managing to get photos of it. And she points out that people often forget how successful the Russians were with their lunar missions.
Well, I remember something that I was always told when I was younger, that the Americans spent millions of dollars in designing this pen that could be used in space because you didn't have to have gravity to feed the ink.
Right.
And they spent all this money and they did all this research into designing this pen. And the joke is that the Russians used a pencil.
Right. I don't know how true that is.
I don't know how true that is either.
It's a good example.
It's a very good example.
But the Russians were the first, and I think they're still the only ones to have done it, but they actually have automated sample return. So, they send these craft up, and they would gather dust and rocks from the moon and then launch and come back. They retrieved one of them.
Yeah, that's right. They only ever did it once because they tried it twice. The first time it failed. But the second time, they got about 170 grams of dust and rock, which they were able just to bring back to the planet for analysis. So, the Russians are pretty ingenious in their technology. It's just a shame that they had to do quite atrocious types of research to get this information.
Oh, the whole space race is fascinating to me. I love reading about the competition between the Americans and the Russians and just how much was achieved because of that competition.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a really great post here and some of these images already revealed are very, very interesting. So, we'll link this in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org if you want to check out some of the high-res scans. And moving from the moon, we head back to Earth for these Chilean sightings. Now, this is post-earthquake UFO terrified bus passengers. It's from Scott Corrales at inexplicata.blogspot.com. It's been a while since Scott Corrales has posted something we've covered on Mysterious Universe. This sighting, very recent, just occurred on the 17th. He wrote, in the early hours of March the 1st, 2010, passengers aboard a bus driving through Iquique were witnesses to a terrifying situation. A woman's screams wakened all of the passengers who joined her in looking out the window. A vertical cylindrical object appeared on the coast, resembling a fluorescent bulb. At the same time, a top-shaped structure appeared out of the sea, surrounded by lights. Suddenly, they saw a long-armed humanoid entity standing nearly 3 meters tall, issuing light and walking toward the highway. This caused panic, said Enrique Silva to a local newspaper. Silva is a UFO expert and is researching this case along with retired Chilean Air Force General Ricardo Bermudez.
These were not the only witnesses to the event, however. Other locals saw the same phenomenon. We are still gathering background information and eyewitness accounts. Some students we identified told us that the driver and his assistant took photos of the event, which could represent very valuable material. This is very interesting and a well-documented case. I haven't had anything like it in Chile in at least 20 years. Now, journalist Juan Andres Salfate says that there are two theories to explain the apparition of UFOs after a catastrophe. The first is that they live among us, underground, and engage in operations to lift off, thus becoming visible. The other is that they live in a state of vigilance and follow our procedures and reactions. That is ridiculous, those two. That is the most ridiculous thing I've heard.
What is? Why?
Well, because he's saying here there are two theories to explain the apparitions of UFOs after a catastrophe. How about, like, is he... He should have given more detail. Like, it could be the fact that people are suffering from extreme trauma after going through such a statewide earthquake that they're imagining this. Or, I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I just think it's very foolish just to mark it up to either we've got people living under the ground that are becoming visible, or that there are aliens living in a state of vigilance that are following our procedures and reactions.
Yeah, right. There is a train of thought that something released within the earth during these earthquakes is causing hallucinations. That is a theory out there.
Right. Okay.
So, there might be some magnetic phenomena, something that we don't understand that is causing people to see strange things. But then it comes back to, like, why are people seeing the same thing? Why is everyone having the same hallucination?
Well, it could be mass hysteria.
Right. So, everyone sees the same thing. How's that explained?
Well, it's possible, but there is mass hysteria that people can feed on and people do see the same thing. But I think it's very silly just to go by, oh, well, it's one of two things that's happening here. Like, add a little bit of an element to explain some type of natural phenomena to explain this.
Well, he's not the first to suggest that there are ET races or perhaps crypto-terrestrials living underground. Remember we mentioned Mac Tonies' new book?
There is no escape from the lair of the mole.
Yeah, the mole people, the mole king as well. But there is more commentary on these large UFO entities.
Well, this is interesting because this is an article also by Scott Corrales, also from inexplicata.blogspot.com. And he says, news of an alleged 3-meter-tall non-human entity shambling towards a roadside in Chile brought back memories of the truly giant UFO occupants that were commonly reported in the 1950s and 1960s in Southern America. This included Argentina, Brazil, and Chile.
So, at the start of that last article we covered, he actually puts a preface there and saying, look, this sounds like crazy internet journalism and I wouldn't pay this attention if it wasn't for the fact that we already have a record of these cases in the Americas.
We'll have a listen to this encounter, and this is called an Argentinian giant. And this is a report of an encounter which occurred in January of 2002. Argentinian researcher Pablo Omasot brought the following case to the attention of Quique Mario, director of the country's UFO research group. The event, a CE3, involved a motorcyclist and a giant entity that had appeared in the January 15 issue of the local newspaper. Enrique Moreno, 19, a clerical worker employed with the Renault Corporation, whose nocturnal job involved acting as a courier for the business documents from one company office to another. Arriving at one of Renault's offices in the dark of night to lay some paperwork in the middle of a table, he realized that the facility's lights flickered on and off inexplicably. Moreno paid no mind to the power fluctuations and hopped on his motorcycle heading for the next destination. Upon reaching a site where vehicles were parked before being sent out across the Andes to Chile, Moreno was amazed to see a giant green figure some 150 meters away. Thinking at first that it might be a welder carrying out his duties at that time of night, the courier got on his motorcycle and drove towards the figure. When he came within 30 metres, his otherwise dependable bike backfired and hesitated, shuddering and becoming almost unmanageable. Moreno had to perform extraordinary efforts to remain in control of his two-wheeler, but he was much more distressed by the glowing figure than by his vehicle's unaccustomed reaction. He says, "I froze after seeing it. It was like a robot standing more than 2 metres tall. Its angled head was... It had shining, luminous eyes and was dressed like a frogman, wearing a belt with a wide oval buckle around its waist. The ungovernable motorcycle shot like an arrow out of control, crossing an open gate and going straight across the road without its driver being able to do a single thing about it. My arms still ache. It robbed me of my strength. I felt as though I was in the middle of a magnetic field. It was cold that night, but the area surrounding me was very hot."
After the experience, Moreno stumbled through the factory's gates, feeling a terrible buzzing in his head as though it were about to explode. Factory personnel immediately drove him to a clinic where he was given sedatives. Although the newspaper considers that the young courier may have hallucinated the experience, it adds that there were other witnesses to the entity that very same evening. A nurse at the same medical facility Moreno had been driven to had administered a sedative to a woman who claimed having seen the same colossal figure levitate through the air and enter an unidentified flying object, an event which was confirmed in turn by residents of Villa de El Libertador who had seen the alleged spacecraft that same evening. As if these corroborating accounts were not enough, there is also the case involving trucker Luftold Rodriguez, who was slowly turning his tractor trailer around and was terrified to find the green giant standing in front of his rig. The giant's presence appeared to drain not only the vehicle's power source, but the trucker's wristwatch and portable radio as well. Given his proximity to the unknown figure, Rodriguez was better able to describe it. The giant, he said, was looking at him inquisitively. It had a flattened head, was completely bald and lacked eyebrows and eyelashes. Its ears were long and it wore a glowing light blue outfit with a broad black belt and white boots. An interesting detail is that Rodriguez reports that the giant had a ball similar to a billiard ball in its left hand. The article in the newspaper offers the following conclusion. It said the giant's attitude was entirely harmless. It could be said to be one of observation. The entity was completely made of energy, perhaps belonging to a form of life in which protoplasm no longer plays any part.
I know exactly what's going on here, Ben.
What's going on, Aaron? Give us the explanation.
Well, clearly, he's wearing this glowing light blue outfit and he's got white boots on. He's going to a Lady Gaga concert.
Oh, you're obsessed. You're obsessed.
Well, what else could it be?
It suggests to me that this entity may be wearing some form of suit. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like when he said it was a robot with an angular head.
Yes.
And angles on the head. It sounds like a helmet.
But how are these newspapers just drawing conclusions? You can't just say the conclusion is that this is an entirely harmless entity.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe the trucker was off his face on Trucker's Choice or something.
Well, but again, we've got multiple witnesses all seeing the same thing, describing the same individual. We've got four witnesses here.
Well,
how can you just say hallucination?
Well, I can't just say hallucination. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I just don't like the way that these journalists are making these far sweeping conclusions. Like, how do they? I mean, I can understand if they offer up a possibility, but you can't say, nope, that's the conclusion. I know, it's something which protoplasm no longer plays any part. What does that even mean?
Yeah, it is funny that they would come to a conclusion. Maybe it was a alternative publication, like a UFO publication.
That's a possibility. Well, listen to this one, Ben. There's one more here. There's actually a few more, but this is the one I'll describe. This is called Tall Fellows and Truck Drivers. It says, much has been written about people's love for their automobiles. Given the number of cars on our roads, the fact is unquestionable. However, not much has been put down on paper regarding the UFO phenomena's similar affection for the humble car. Prior to the age of abductions, a fair share of UFO cases involved unsuspecting motorists. Now, the person in this article has not revealed their name. All they've been named is RV. And it says, RV never suspected he would be one of them. As he drove at 3 o'clock in the morning along Spain's A6 highway from the city of Logrono back to his home in the Basque Country, the anonymous protagonist of our story was more interested in pulling into the nearest rest area rather than having a close encounter with the unknown. As luck would have it, he found one such rest stop further along the road, deserted, but for the presence of a large French tractor trailer whose driver had obviously had the same idea. RV parked his Citroen BX, turned off the ignition, and promptly shut his eyes, drifting off to sleep before he even knew it. Despite being a sound sleeper, RV was awakened by a slight buzzing sound and a bright light, which at first he thought to come from another vehicle, perhaps another articulated trailer, pulling into the rest stop. The bright light gradually dimmed to extinction, and early morning darkness reigned over the area once more. Even as he reflected on the sudden burst of light's origin, RV saw the driver of the French tractor trailer exit the cab of his vehicle and approach the car with great urgency, pointing to the empty field adjacent to the rest area. "Did you see that?" asked the trucker in French. RV cautiously got out of his car and was stunned. The source of the unexpected brightness turned out to be a vast, dark structure, blacker than the surrounding night. The French trucker brimmed over with fear and nervous excitement, but willingly followed RV's lead towards the dark structure. So RV was later interviewed by a Spanish ufologist, and he could not explain what had possessed him to take the lead in a potentially foolhardy excursion, and he admitted to not being a very cautious person. Both men walked an estimated 10 metres towards the ominous object before running into what can be best described as an invisible wall. RV's eyeglasses pressed against his face as they hit the strange barrier, which he described to the UFO researcher as having a gelatinous or plastic consistency. Even scarier was the green luminescence which emerged from nowhere to outline the looming dark structure.
The French trucker vented a few choice expletives in his language, which caused RV to take a second look at the structure with the greenish cast. Twin colossi had seemingly emerged from the vehicle, advancing slowly towards the humans. Knees trembling with fear, RV guessed their height at 3 meters and their width seemed to match. During the interview, RV was careful to state that he did not believe the colossi were robots, at least not mechanicals as we've come to understand them. They moved in unison, he said, as though they were reflections of one another. Their faces were featureless, their arms hung by their sides, and their massive legs appeared to be slightly articulated. Silent in the darkness, the pair of giants stared impassively at the two humans at a distance of 5 meters. Whatever courage or curiosity the truck driver and RV may have felt evaporated, both men broke into a frantic run, eventually hiding behind RV's car. The entire event, which lasted about an hour, ended with a very slight buzzing sound coming from the dark structure, which began moving away at low altitude before disappearing. RV guessed that the structure could have conceivably been 100 meters in diameter, and never once thought that the object and its silent crew could have been the product of any Earth technology. He said any country that has access to such artifacts will dominate the planet at its leisure. But the details surrounding the brush with the unknown were even stranger. During the entire hour, not a single car or truck had driven past the rest area in spite of the fact that the A6 highway is a major artery. The French trucker jumped aboard his rig and put the hammer down, zooming away from the rest area at top speed, not even bothering to exchange notes with RV regarding the bizarre occurrence both had shared. The battery of RV's Citroen BX became unable to hold a charge despite the fact that the car was only a year old. Strange blister-like deformities appeared on the rear windshield and the front bumper, the parts of the Citroen which were made of plastic. Mechanics attributed them to proximity to a heat source, Magnetic media didn't fare much better. RVs, credit cards refused to work at automatic teller machines. Researcher Benitez was not disappointed when he visited the rest area in search of physical evidence. Only a short distance away from the black-topped parking lot, he found a large swath of grassy terrain that looked bleached and broken in comparison with the surroundings, desiccated without showing signs of having been singed or burned.
So certainly a very bizarre encounter there, Ben. I do find it interesting that they're describing the fact that nothing went past for an hour. Do you think missing time, perhaps?
Well, I was thinking that they may have had, you know, they mentioned invisible barriers there.
Yeah, that could have been like in a split second to everyone else, but to them it was over an hour.
Yeah, so perhaps they entered another dimension briefly during this encounter, like they were somehow manipulating time.
Mm.
But isn't that weird? The descriptions almost matched the previous encounter with this large 3 meter tall greenish being.
Yes.
These things, you know, looked kind of, he said they weren't robots, but they walked kind of mechanically. And it seems as though they may have been wearing suits again because of the descriptions of them.
Well, we always talk about the Greys being some type of biological machine. Perhaps this is the same technology with another species.
Right.
Who knows? I mean, it's quite far out there. Well, certainly interesting stuff, Ben. We're going to take another quick break. You're listening to Mysterious Universe Plus. Don't go away. Welcome back to Mysterious Universe Plus, and now we move over to naturalplane.blogspot.com, which of course is Lon's blog at Phantoms and Monsters. This really interesting encounter has come up. It's about the Betty Andreasen Luca alien abduction, which occurred on January the 25th in 1967. The article says that one of the most documented and believable cases in ufology is the experience of one woman's abduction aboard a UFO. Her name is Betty Andreasen Luca. She is a devout Christian, and during her abduction, she was taken before a being of intense light and love called the One. Her first abduction occurred during her childhood and culminated with an abduction experience that involved her whole family. This incident occurred on the night of January the 25th in 1967. Now, this occurred in Massachusetts. Betty was in her kitchen around 6:30 p.m. on the night of her abduction. The rest of the family, 7 children, her mother and father were in the living room. The lights in the house began to blink, and a red light beamed into the house through the kitchen window. Betty's kids were on the edge after the lights blinked, and she ran to quiet them down. Startled by the red beam, Betty's father ran to look out the kitchen window to see where the light was coming from. He was amazed to see 5 creatures heading towards their house in a hopping motion, and was startled when the creatures simply walked through the wooden door of the kitchen. In a moment, the entire family was put into a type of trance. Betty's father was attended to by one of the creatures, while another began to have a telepathic conversation with Betty. She and her father both thought that one of the creatures was the leader, who was about 5 feet tall. The other 4 were approximately a foot shorter. They had very wide eyes, small ears and noses, set in a pear-shaped head. There were only slits where their mouths should have been. They only communicated with their minds. The 5 creatures wore a blue coverall with a wide belt. On their sleeves could be seen a logo of a bird. 3 fingers were on their hands and their feet were shod with boots. They did not actually walk, but they floated as they moved along. Betty later recalled that she was not frightened by their presence, but instead felt rather calm. Meanwhile, Betty's mother and children were still in a state of suspended animation. When Betty seemed worried about them, the aliens released her 11-year-old daughter from the trance to assure her that no harm was being done to her family. Soon, Betty was taken by the aliens to a waiting craft, which rested on a hill outside of her home. Betty estimated the craft to be about 20 feet in diameter and saucer-shaped. Betty recalls that after she was aboard the craft, it took off and joined a mothership. There, she was subjected to a physical examination and the victim of tests by strange equipment. She was given one test which caused her pain, but resulted in it being a religious awakening. She estimates that she was gone for 4 hours before being brought home by 2 of the aliens. Returning home, she ran to see the rest of her family. They were still in some kind of suspended state. All along, one of the aliens had waited behind with her family. Finally, they were released from their bonds of the trance and the aliens left. Betty had been hypnotized and told not to reveal any details of her experience. Though some of the details of her abduction were temporarily lost to her, something she was able to recall. She remembers the power outage, the red beam of light coming into the house, and the aliens coming in. Some 8 years after her experience, she answered an ad from researcher Dr. J. Allen Hynek. He was soliciting for anyone who may have had an alien experience. The letter she sent to Hayneck was rejected, however, being too bizarre to be believed. 2 more years would transpire before her story would be investigated. The group of investigators include an electronics engineer, an aerospace engineer, and a telecommunications specialist. This also included a solar physicist and a UFO investigator. Betty's case of alien abduction was very strange and contained much more information than the average case. For 12 months, Betty was involved in a character analysis, polygraph examinations, psychiatric review, and 14 sessions of regressive hypnosis. The results of this analysis were presented in a 528-page review. The review basically stated that Betty and the daughters were sane individuals, believing in their experience as presented. In the rest of this article, which we'll link to in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org, there's actually the entire hypnotic regression transcripts, which Lon's found.
Yeah, Lon's done a huge amount of research on this post. Definitely check it out. The hypnotic regression is frustrating, isn't it?
Look, there's a couple of things that grab me about this, which kind of, I mean, I'm sure that she does genuinely believe what is going on here, but I mean, I don't know if it's trauma, mental illness, whatever's going on. But I mean, you raised a valid point, which I'll speak about in a moment. But the fact is that she was a devout religious person. And then all of a sudden in her regression, she's talking about being with the creator and meeting these very religious...
The Heavenly Father, all the deities.
It makes it very difficult. And in fact, even Lon himself makes a comment at the end of his article where he says, I honestly have reservations for several reasons, and the inclusion of a religious deity by an abductee who is a devout believer sends up my radar. So... he does say that nonetheless, she does seem to be sincere in all of her interviews and has convinced many experts in the field. So I totally agree with Lon there. But at the same time, I still think, well, it does raise sort of issues. But then again, you said to me before, perhaps that's what they showed her. So it was a pleasant experience for
her. Yeah, I mean, we won't go into the detail. You can read it on Phantoms and Monsters. But she basically gets taken to a room, and during the hypnotic regression, it can't be revealed what's inside this room. She eventually goes in there. But she keeps saying to the hypnotist, I can't take you with me. I can't take you with me. And when she gets back from this room, she describes this transcendental experience, but she can't put it into words what it was. She can't explain to him what he saw, and she's not allowed to. She's not permitted to share what she saw in there. So the very fact that there's this room that they take to, this special room she goes into, makes me think that perhaps these beings were able to create her ultimate experience for her. Like, if they had abducted someone from a different background, you know, say someone from...
like me, Lady Gaga concert.
Exactly. Or someone from India, they might see Krishna or, you know, a Hindu god in that room.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't quite trust these beings is what I'm trying to say. It's interesting, some of the descriptions of them, the fact that they're wearing blue coveralls, and we keep mentioning his experiences, but it brings me back to David Huggins' paintings. And of course, all the entities he painted, the small little typical grey creatures, are wearing these blue overalls. And the fact that they have a bird logo on them.
Yeah, that's a bit weird.
That's kind of cool.
It's kind of Thunderbirds.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. But yeah, huge amount of information on this case. A classic, classic case. Lon's done a really good job of doing a kind of overall look at it. But there's... I mean, there's over 3 or 4 books published on her case alone based on Hynek's research. So, lots and lots to check out on that case.
Now, moving over to a little something that we wanted to put out there for our listeners in California. There's a new exhibition that's showing up. And I don't know if we've spoken about this before, Ben, but they've actually found, archaeologists have found mummies of European descent in China. Well before any Europeans would have thought to have been in the China area.
Yeah, these are the famous Tarim mummies. And when these were first discovered, it basically, you know, threw a wrench into the understanding of the East and West and how they intermingled in ancient past. If you head to the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org, we'll embed a recent National Geographic special on the Tarim mummies. I'll play a little bit of audio from the very first episode for you now.
Mummies with Caucasian features have been found in China. It's a discovery that could change history. Did Westerners make it to China more than 3,000 years before Marco Polo?
There are probably only a handful of finds of this nature in every century. It is too good to be true. It's too interesting.
It's a mystery that only the most advanced forensic tools of the 21st century can solve.
So these mummies were first discovered in 1934 by Swedish archaeologist Folke Bergman, and then they were forgotten about for 66 years until they were relocated through GPS navigation by a Chinese expedition. Archaeologists began excavating it from 2003 to 2005, and their reports were translated and summarized by Victor H. Mayer, a professor of Chinese at the University of Pennsylvania. And if you go and watch the National Geographic videos, his story is pretty fascinating because he basically went into this Chinese museum and was expecting to look at pots and tools and things. And he kind of found this little room and just found these mummies everywhere, like all these dug up mummies, and was absolutely amazed that they had blonde hair, Caucasian features. They were over 6 feet tall. Obviously not Chinese. So we thought, what on earth is going on? What are these Western mummies doing in the Tarim Basin in China?
Well, it comes back to the whole fact that I think there's so much about history that we don't know. And I still am a firm believer that we've had far more advanced civilizations than what we've had now. I keep on saying it, but the evidence points to it, doesn't it?
Even if you don't go back as far as advanced civilizations in the past, the amount of traveling that ancient peoples did in this cycle of civilization, I think, is much more than we understand today.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially since we covered the tobacco in the Egyptian mummies.
And the cocaine.
On last week's episode, and talked about transoceanic travel between the old world and the new world. And lots of mysteries still remain, but they seem to think that these people came from Siberia. There was a recent New York Times article that pointed out that there's DNA markers that link Siberians and Europeans, so they may have interbred and then moved down into that region in China.
Well, it makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. I mean, it's all a large landmass. It's all the same continent, isn't it? So even though they're very distant geographical locations, so I wouldn't be surprised that they would be able to migrate across them.
And Dr. Mayer mentions in that National Geographic video that he had read many, many stories in ancient Chinese texts talking about these wild, wild-haired people that used to live, way off into the West. So it's interesting that there's evidence of those stories. So this exhibition, it's the first time it's ever been taken out of Asia.
That's amazing.
First time we've ever had these mummies outside of China. The exhibition is at the Bowers Museum in Santa Ana, California. So if you're in the area, check it out. It opens on March the 27th. We're going to take a quick break now and come back with some more from Jason Offutt's blog. More stories on Harlequins. You're listening to Mysterious Universe Plus. Don't go away.
And welcome back to Mysterious Universe Plus. Now, Ben, Jason is amazing. He writes really great articles. He's a really great guy to get along with. He's been wonderful when we've interviewed him in the past. But you know what I don't like about him?
What?
He's really not helping me with my phobia about clowns.
Oh, no. He's got the new Harlequins are back.
He has got some great articles about Harlequins. Now, the fact that they're even called Harlequins just makes my fear of clowns even worse. This is a really intriguing account. He says that this is the first of a two-part series about encounters with an entity known as the Harlequin. The entity began visiting Dan Mitchell of Wisconsin when he was 5 years old. He's found he's not alone. Now, we'll link to this in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org. You can also find Jason's website at from-the-shadows.blogspot.com. Now, Jason writes, the woman walking in the street seemed odd. Laurie Smithmeyer of Kansas and a friend visited nearby Lawrence, home of the University of Kansas, for lunch and shopping in early 2000. She says, we both enjoy art and all types of cultural events, so it was common for us to go hang out there, eat lunch and shop. They ate at the Free State Brewery, although they didn't partake in the Free State microbrews, and walked south down Massachusetts Street, enjoying a late spring day. Then, they saw the woman. She says, we were approximately in front of an old bank that had been remade into a restaurant named Teller's when we saw her. The person seemed to be a female figure. The individual wore a short ruffled skirt, similar to a ballet tutu, and a vest that looked like a red, purple and black velvet bustier. The figure wore long gloves and tights. Her hair was a dark, unkempt, wild tangle. Smithmeyer says her clothing was oddly theatrical and reminded me of a carnival or circus in a way. I recall dark eyes, which may have been makeup or something. I did not get a very good look at her face at all, just a glimpse from the side. The figure went towards a park bench that sat across the sidewalk from the entrance to the Teller's restaurant. She says, as we passed her on the sidewalk, I got the impression she was going to sit on the bench and we kept walking. As we got to the curb to cross the street, we both looked at each other and said, wow, did you see that girl? The women both turned around to look at her and she was gone. She says, gone from the bench, gone from the sidewalk, gone from the street. She just disappeared. And in the space of us taking 3 to 4 steps on a bright, sunny, clear day, she had vanished, not just from the bench, but from the entire area. Only a few people wandered the streets, so Smithmeyer is certain the figure couldn't have gotten lost in the crowd. The street is level with no changes in elevation or terrain that would make it hard for her to see. She was not on either side of the street. As far as we could see, she had disappeared.
The women looked at each other and said, Fae, which means elf. She said that was the impression we were left with. We have both studied myth and folklore and are familiar with stories of the elves of Ireland, and that was basically our feeling about that figure. Unworldly and very strange. Smithmeyer, who read the stories of Dan Mitchell's Harlequin encounters at From the Shadows, thinks she and her friend saw something similar. She asked, could this have been a Harlequin-type apparition? I remember the impression I had of the figure was not entirely human. It was just so bizarre and scary, ethereal at the same time. It is really hard to describe. The closest that comes to mind is a fairy. Extraterrestrial never crossed my mind. Smithmeyer said she's familiar with alternative cultures and this entity was not one of those. She said this was beyond anything a mere costume could be. I've seen goth people, street performers, artists, and all kinds of role players, and I'm very familiar with that subculture, as is the friend that was with me. There was a quality of unearthliness about her that is hard to describe. So Jason adds that next week, the Harlequin visits a woman named Karen when she was a child. Isn't he great at finding all these stories that have the same theme?
Yeah, he's amazing.
Perhaps the same sighting of a similar entity.
But you know what? This really freaks me out because it's quite ambiguous. There's no sort of end to this. She just disappeared. It's like, what could she be doing hanging around? It's like, has she come from a different world and she's just sort of lost or doesn't know what's going on and suddenly is sucked back? Like, there's something really freaky about it.
And it was also mentioned that she had black type eyes, almost black eyes. It makes me think of the black-eyed kids, which yes. I'm really looking forward to asking Jason about next week when he appears on Mysterious Universe. We're going to have him on our midweek show to talk about his new book, which you've read a little bit from the new book, haven't you?
I have, and it's really amazing. The whole premise of this book is that he's got two criteria. One, it has to be paranormal, of course. But the second is that he's looking for events that have occurred within a 100-kilometer radius of his home.
Wow.
And he has come up with some amazing encounters. And he's right. There are paranormal events that happen everywhere. You don't have to be listening about the Loch Ness Monster and all these things that happen in all these sort of obscure locations. Stuff happens right in your neighborhood that you don't even know about.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the book is out yet. I think it's very, very soon coming to bookstores.
You've got to pick it up. It is a really good book from what I've read. So I've got to still finish it over the weekend before we speak to him. But great book so far. Really well written.
It's called What Lurks Beyond.
That's right.
So look out for that and looking forward to speaking with Jason next week. If you have any questions you want to ask about black-eyed kids, send them in after listening to this episode and we'll see if we can pass them on in the interview. Moving on now to some cryptid stories, we head to theheraldstandard.com. Well, there's been a flooding of Bigfoot sightings in Pennsylvania all across Fayette County. An article's recently written on a Bigfoot sighting north of Uniontown by a woman who wished to remain anonymous, and it was published in August. Now, her account was investigated by members of the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, and researcher Stan Gordon of Greensburg, perhaps best known for his investigation into an alleged 1965 UFO crash in Kecksburg. Now, following the publication of this article, the director of the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, Eric Altman, reported that he had received phone calls about 8 additional Bigfoot sightings in Fayette County, 4 of which were clustered around the Dunbar region. So this brings up an interesting point, and we often talk about this in terms of UFO sightings and encounters. It's almost like this article prompted people to suddenly come forth with their story, almost as if they needed someone to step out there first to give them the courage to come forward.
Yeah, but absolutely. I mean, that's normal human nature, even if it isn't something paranormal we're talking about. Like, if you see a fight on the street or something is going on, generally people won't do anything until they see someone else do something.
Right, it's an old psychology experiment,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. But I really like some of the encounters they're reporting here about some stuff that's been occurring relatively recently. Now, there's one here that says the latest sighting report came from Heath Landman of Dunbar, who said he doesn't mind revealing his identity and claims that his son, Heath Nicholas Jr., who was 20 years old, saw something crossing the road in front of them about 35 to 40 yards away as they were driving on Ferguson Road in Dunbar at 9:15 p.m. on Saturday the 31st of January. Now, he says this creature was walking at a fast pace on 2 feet. It stood about 6 feet 3 inches tall and had a cone-shaped head. It was moving a good clip without running. It got across the road in 3 steps, then headed up an embankment and into the thicket. The next thing I knew, I heard my son say, "My God, Dad, what was that?" I think that there's something going on with these creatures. I still think that the aliens are just dropping them off like, "Here you go for a piddle, off you go."
Well, after they explored the area, they ended up finding hair left on a fence. So they're hoping to get that tested, DNA testing done on that hair sample. Another incident took place on September the 23rd last year in the mountains near Dunbar. A mother and daughter out for a drive stopped at a pipeline to take in the view and heard a rustling noise in the brush below. Thinking it might be a bear or a deer, they later saw it was an upright creature, very muscular and tall. They said they reported that the creature got to within 150 feet and just walked away without looking at them or threatening them in any way. The researcher Altman met with the witnesses the following morning. They also told him while hiking around the vicinity of the sighting, they discovered a large 19-inch foot-shaped impression in an area where the brush had been trampled underfoot. While investigating yet another sighting report in the Dunbar area, Altman discovered a deer kill that had been eaten away until only the head and hide remained, as well as a 3-by-10-foot lean-type structure in the area. And another unusual sighting at the end of July involved a woman who claims to have spotted two creatures just outside Dunbar. There was a smaller one eating on some blackberries and a much larger one estimated to be about 10 feet tall. There have been several reports of multiple sightings in other parts of the state, said Altman. Many claim that the creatures have large dark eyes and range in size from 7 to 10 feet. They are muscular and bulky and have a variety of hair colour.
You know, it's interesting. I like it how it's reported that this creature saw them. And, oh yeah, you know, he wasn't really bothered by them. Off he goes. Like, it reminds me of gorillas, because gorillas in the forest, like if you run into chimps when you're out in the, not in the forest, but out in their habitat, chimps are actually quite violent creatures and they're quite aggressive. Whereas gorillas, while they protect themselves, if you get down to their level and if you are, you know, if you don't harass them or make eye contact with them, gorillas actually will eventually allow you into their circle and hang around with you. Yep. So,
accounts of Sasquatch actually attacking people are very few and far between.
Yeah.
It almost seems with these encounters that they're just indifferent to humans. It's like they're aware of a human's existence, but totally indifferent to them. And they just basically move out of the area when they see you. And it's suggested that they're actually aware of you a lot earlier than you're aware of them.
Do you know, in some ways, I kind of do. It reminds me of Autumn Williams, and I hope that we do find proof of them one day, but at the same time, I don't, because I would hate to see these creatures end up in a zoo or something like that. But moving on to something a little more interesting, this man, and we've spoken about this before, this guy has woken up out of a coma to find that he has a foreign accent. This is from the eveningtimes.co.uk. It's written by Sarah Swain and was published on the 15th of March. And she says, after spending his whole life in lugs, Tom Patterson once had an Ayrshire accent. But when a car crash left him in a coma for 6 weeks, he woke up with a different voice. Tom, 39, now speaks with an accent which sounds strangely European. He believes that he has the rare condition foreign accent syndrome, which can affect sufferers of brain injuries or strokes. He says, I'd say it's what I have. It gives me an explanation. When I came to, I thought my voice is funny. Folks were saying, where are you from? All my life, I've been Tom from Largs, and now people think I'm Tomas from Poland. People ask, have you always stayed in Largs? I've been Portuguese, German, Spanish, French, even Israeli. The most common are Belgian, Norwegian, or German.
So this foreign accent syndrome, we've covered it on the show before. It's extremely rare, but always happens after some sort of brain injury, some sort of accident. They're not actually speaking in another accent. It just kind of sounds like that to everyone else's ears.
So experts say that tiny areas of damage in various parts of the brain might explain changes to the vocal features. Tom has therapy to improve his speech, which is still slurred, but he says his new voice doesn't bother him because he's lucky to be alive. So that's a good point. At least he's happy that he's alive. But I was actually thinking about this when I was reading it. And the way that we speak because obviously it's what we pick up around us, but also it comes down to the motor function within our vocal cords and within our tongue as well.
Right.
So, if you suffer a stroke or have some type of brain damage, if you affect the neurons that move or are responsible for those regions in your body, it could change the way that your vocal cords react and the way that your tongue moves. So, obviously, that's how they're developing. It must damage that, so it's changing the way that they speak. And this is why they're developing this accent. And obviously, it's quite an ambiguous accent because they can't pinpoint. I mean, this guy's been French, Spanish, German, Portuguese.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like all of a sudden he's speaking with a spot-on Italian accent. It doesn't work like that. It can be pretty much interpreted as anything.
That's right. Now, while I find that to be bizarre, it's not that far-fetched. What I do find to be far more strange is this article which I found from dailymail.co.uk. And this is a reasonably old article. It's from September of 2007, but I thought I'd bring it up because this Czech Speedway rider was knocked out in a crash and then he woke up speaking perfect English.
Yeah, so this guy could only speak parrot English. He only knew a few English phrases. He has this motorcycle accident and he's completely fluent, not broken at all. His friends were baffled, absolutely amazed. He woke up, you know, just speaking to the paramedics without an accent. He didn't have his Czech accent anymore. He had just had a perfect English accent. Peter Waite, the promoter of the guy's writing team, said, "I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Before his crash, his use of English language was broken, to put it mildly. He was only just making a start on improving it and struggled to be understood, but was keen to learn. Yet here we were at the ambulance door listening to him talking to the medical staff in perfect English." We've actually covered this guy's story on the show before, way back in season one, but I thought it linked in perfectly with this foreign accent syndrome. But this is something else entirely, isn't it?
It's something else entirely, but wait for it, because he injured a knee in an accident in Glasgow later on. And once more, he's struggling to make himself understood in English. So he only developed this sort of, let's say, I wouldn't call it a power, but ability for a short amount of time, then he has another accident and all of a sudden he can't speak it again.
But it knocked his, he hit his knee and knocked it out of him?
I don't know. It's very strange. Apparently now he can only string two or three words of English together.
Well, the writer himself had a really good understanding of it. He basically said, "I must have, you know, tons of English in my subconscious because you hear it all the time. I hear it all the time. I must have the entire English vocabulary stored somewhere in my brain, and this accident just made me recall it."
Well, that's right. The vocabulary and the syntax must be picked up from somewhere, so you must hear it from television. I mean, Europe is quite a diverse area, so perhaps he's picked it up from hearing it in television or something like that. But it also says down the bottom here that the writer of this article has heard other people getting knocked out and waking up talking fluent Italian. Like, isn't that crazy? You'd be speaking English and all of a sudden you'd speak fluent Italian.
Yeah, there's lots of stories like that, and a couple of them, as I said, we've covered them previously, but really interesting stuff. And again, just goes to show just how little of our brains we use, just how much potential is yet to be tapped into from our human bodies.
We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we're going to finish up with some science news. You're listening to Mysterious Universe. Don't go away. And welcome back to Mysterious Universe Plus. While NASA has had a lot of its budget cut, and we're not going into space for a little while, at least not to the moon, they've had to come up with a few other little projects. Now, this thing is absolutely amazing. This article comes from news.yahoo.com. It's by Seth Borenstein. And apparently, in a surprising discovery about where high life can thrive, scientists for the first time have found a shrimp-like creature and jellyfish frolicking beneath the massive Antarctic ice sheet.
How does anything live under the Antarctic ice sheet?
Wait for it. It's 600 feet below the ice where no light shines, and scientists have figured nothing much more than a few microbes could exist. Now, this is why a NASA team was surprised when they lowered a video camera to get a first look at the underbelly of the ice sheet in Antarctica. Now, a curious shrimp-like creature was swimming by, and then it parked itself on the camera's cable. Scientists also pulled up a tentacle, which they believe came from a foot-long jellyfish.
I love that, that it just landed on the cable. Like, they weren't expecting to find anything down there, and this little shrimp just jumps on their cable. Like, hey, guys.
It's incredible. It says that this video is likely to inspire experts to think what they know about life in harsh environments. And it has scientists musing that the shrimp-like creatures can frolic below 600 feet in the Antarctic. In this freezing, it's this sub-freezing dark water, it shows that there's so much about this planet we don't know, which could mean, like the frozen moon of Jupiter, which is Europa.
Right, I was just thinking that. Imagine all the moons that we have, which look like they may have ice, may have water. There could be life there.
Definitely. And the thing is, though, is that we've always had microbes that live in the most inhospitable locations. Like, we talk about there's microbes that live in the hot, the steaming hot vents underneath the ocean. You know, there's
right,
like
near where volcanic, the volcanic vents. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And these microbes live down there. So the fact that they've found jellyfish and these shrimp sort of creatures hanging around really indicates that there could be this life on other planets. But what I always find interesting is that we discuss that space is the final frontier. And while it is, I still think that the oceans of this planet are still a final frontier for us. There's still places that we can't go yet because we don't have the technology to be able to get...
The pressure's too great to go deep enough.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, I thought there was a really telling quote at the end. Because one of the researchers said, it's pretty amazing when you find a huge puzzle like that on a planet where we thought we know everything.
Yeah, that bothers me.
So, it's just indicative of the attitude of our modern society and our modern science.
What did I tell you about scientists? We don't know everything. And I hope that we never know everything because learning and discovering new things is what humanity is meant to do.
And speaking of our modern people's attitude towards things, Delhi officials have unveiled a giant public air freshener to scrub their atmosphere clean.
Oh, Ben.
Isn't this indicative of how we solve our problems today? Really a band-aid effect. The 7-ton System Life Seater costs 25 million rupees, about £357,000. It sucks in 10,000 cubic meters of dirty air an hour, subjects it to a filtering process, and then emits clean air. Delhi officials say that more of the machines will be bought if the current one, installed at one of Delhi's busiest traffic junctions, proves a success. The city's health chief, PK Sharma, said, "We will evaluate its efficacy after 3 months. If it works, we will buy more." Delhi is the second dirtiest city in the world in terms of amount of particulate matter in the atmosphere, according to the World Bank. Now, again, like, what a band-aid approach. And you think, instead of looking at maybe investigating different types of energy.
There is such a far distribution between the rich and the poor in India. So there are so many bad cars out there which produce copious amounts of pollutants. Why don't they look at investing this money into an alternative form of public
transportation? Public transport. Get the cars off the road. Get more people using public transport.
This is how bad it is. Listen to this. Athletes due to compete in Delhi in the Commonwealth Games, which will begin in October, are being advised to arrive in the city at the last possible moment to minimize the risk to their respiratory systems. That's really bad. They're athletes and they're having to arrive at the last possible minute so they don't damage their respiratory systems.
Well, it's only going to get worse because they say that by 2030, the number of vehicles on the country's roads is going to increase sevenfold to about 380 million cars.
Oh, we're in so much trouble. But think about the amount of resources it's costing to build these air pollution plants.
And to run them. I mean, imagine like the electricity to run these things. It must be quite substantial.
Well, who knows what type of power. I'm not too sure what power systems that India uses. But if it's coal power, it means that they're burning coal and creating pollutant matter just so they can suck it up with these machines, which would probably function at a lower efficiency.
If you take a step back and look at this, it, at first glance, it seems like a great idea. We're cleaning the air, but it really is just silly.
It's just ridiculous.
It's just, humanity's not approaching things the right way. And speaking of doom and gloom, this time we look at this French TV experiment.
Which I want to go on this.
Shows the dark side of humanity.
Oh, I like it how I say that. You say that right after I say that I want to go on this.
This has been all over the news. This was from the AFP. where game show contestants turn torturers in a new psychological experiment for French television. I'm sure a lot of you have already seen this. It was supposedly called The Game of Death, and it ended up just being a social experiment. They got a bunch of volunteers. I think there was 80 of them. And they set up this fake TV show where the contestants had to sit there and get their other person on the side of a glass panel to answer questions. And every time they got the questions wrong, the contestant would zap them with this electricity. And it got to the point where the actor on the other side, they didn't know he was an actor, obviously, he would get enough wrong that he would drop dead. He would scream before dropping dead. And after 80 contestants, only 16 of them walked out. The rest of them were quite happy to torture the guy to his death. What is going on?
So they actually thought they were killing someone.
Yes.
Oh my God. I didn't realize it was that bad. Wow. How could you do that?
This is the experiment. See, so there's the idea that if you put people in a certain situation, a certain controlled situation.
So this is being likened to how soldiers were instructed by the Nazis to usher people into the showers and the gas chambers, right?
That's right. There's that kind of collective persuasion that was demonstrated in this social experiment. There's a quote here from one of the contestants. She said, "Since I was a little girl, I've always asked myself why the Nazis did it. How could they obey such orders? And there I was, obeying them myself." Another contestant said, "I was worried about the guy getting electrocuted, but at the same time, I was afraid to spoil the program."
Oh my God, killing someone. Oh, I don't want to ruin the TV show. Can you imagine Mysterious Universe? I don't want to kill our guest, but I don't want to stuff up the show.
Yeah, we don't want to ruin an episode.
We want to see if we can communicate with a ghost.
Yeah, so it's kind of disturbing. It's disturbing that they're doing the experiment, but the results are, you know, even more disturbing.
Do you know, I've got no surprises in what the human psyche is capable of, really. You know what I mean? We really are sheep when you think about it sometimes.
Well, the kind of underlying point they're trying to make is the authority of television.
Yes.
And the fact that you've got not only the group kind of persuasion, but the fact that there's lights, there's cameras, and there's actually a contract they signed before. They don't go into any details, but I'm sure it says something like, "You will participate with what we go along with."
Oh, well, let's try a little experiment. Okay, everyone who is listening to this will join Mysterious Universe Plus.
But they're already Plus members, you dill.
That's not the point.
So, yeah, as disturbing as that is, I'm kind of curious to watch that.
Yeah, I would like to see, like, it's psychology is a really fascinating thing.
Yeah, I would just like to see the looks on the faces when the actor pretends to die and just how much anguish they're actually going through.
Yeah, what would you do?
Maybe they're just completely passive and they're like, "Yeah, I won." He's dead.
And here's your new lawn chair.
And our final article for the day, which is quite fitting because I'm getting a bit hungry over here. This is the 11 places that serve your pet for dinner.
This is horrible, Ben. How did you find this article?
This is a great article. Number 11 is pretty tame. This is from the US. Goat meat tacos have become a staple at many roadside taco trucks throughout the United States. These taco trucks are like mini mobile kitchens with the capacity to cook and serve food from wherever the truck is parked. Although goat meat tacos have been a favorite in Mexico for generations, their popularity is rising steadily in the US.
Goat's okay. I could eat goat. I mean, I eat goat cheese.
Goat's not too bad. What about in China? You can get guilingao.
Oh, that sounds nice.
It's turtle shell jelly.
Oh.
It's a jelly-like dessert made from the powdered shell of the golden coin turtle. And there's a popular dish at dim sum all over China. People enjoy the jelly not only for its taste, but for its reported medicinal value. Moving on, this isn't much nicer. This is from Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador. The roasted guinea pig.
What?
In Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador, roasted guinea pig has been eaten by the local farming population for over 4,000 years.
Oh, well, each to their own, I guess.
Guinea pigs are a variety of rodent, though, and are kept as pets in the US. They are bred specifically for eating in guinea pig farms. In certain parts of Central America, they've got a pig here. This isn't like any guinea pig I've ever seen. That's a damn big guinea pig.
Didn't you have guinea pigs when you were a kid?
Yeah, delicious.
You didn't eat them.
Delicious.
You didn't eat them.
Number 8, we head to Korea. Baby mice wine. It's an incredibly potent Korean concoction that is made of fermented mice fetuses and rice wine. The process for making the wine is simple. Mice fetuses are harvested when they are only a few days old and don't yet have their hair or open eyes, then multiple mice are dropped into a bottle of rice wine and left to ferment for at least a year. The resulting wine has been described as tasting like roadkill mixed with gasoline. Number 7 on the list is from Germany, the Hasenpfeffer, the rabbit. The rabbit's not bad.
Everyone's had rabbit.
A rabbit before. I'm going to skip that, Germany. That's nothing. Number 6 is Nicaragua, green iguana soup.
Oh, I like lizards.
Delicious as well. Oh. Also delicious. Green iguanas are eaten year-round throughout Central and South America, but they're especially popular during Holy Week in Nicaragua. Unfortunately, green iguana females ovulate right around April, and so during Holy Week, the iguanas are swollen with eggs, making the consumption of them during that time particularly disastrous for the population.
Oh.
So you got to be careful. You don't want to kill off the iguanas.
I love iguanas.
Eating a reptile, though. Actually, I've had crocodile before. Have you had crocodile here?
No, my brother-in-law has had snake.
No, I don't know about snake, but I've had croc meat before.
Ew.
Philippines, balut. This is where... I've seen this before. This is where they get the duck.
That's horrible, though. It's like a duck in an egg, isn't it?
It's a fertilized duck egg, but it's boiled while the fetus is still in the egg.
Oh.
So, yeah, that's horrible. I don't like that one. Not as delicious as number 4, Cambodia, fried tarantulas.
Yeah, I could eat that.
Although these little guys are fried up all over Cambodia, the Sukhon market is known for serving the tastiest fried tarantulas. And they've developed a bit of a cult following. Tourists and locals come to the region specifically to get their fix. You should see this picture, Aaron. There's a lady here holding a pile of fried tarantulas, like a mountain of them.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. But how could you? Because remember how we did that story about that guy that got the tarantula hairs in his eyeballs?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, do they, like, scale them like a fish before? Like, imagine if you got that into your stomach lining, it could cause a really bad stomach upset.
Well, all the hair would be burnt off when they're being fried, you would hope.
I guess so.
They look pretty cooked in this photo.
Right.
For number 3, we head back to China for snake soup. It's a traditional dish eaten all over China. The very best version of this delicacy comes from Kwelin Street in Kowloon District of Hong Kong. This street is famous for snake that is so fresh, the reptiles are still alive when you pick them. Number 2, we head to Japan for basashi.
What's that?
Horse.
Oh, horse.
Yep. Horse.
No, I don't think I could eat a horse either. That's not good.
There's nothing wrong with horse meat. It's just like a cow. But
have you had it?
No. Japan is known for some adventurous cuisine, and basashi is no exception. The dish consists of horse served raw like sashimi.
Oh.
With a simple soy dipping sauce on the side.
Have you ever had kangaroo?
Yeah, kangaroo is delicious.
Yeah, I'm not keen on kangaroo.
Well, you won't try anything.
No, I will, but kangaroo is not. I find kangaroo to be very sweet.
And number 1, my personal favourite from South Korea, bosintang soup.
Oh, what is that?
It's dog.
Oh, that's horrible.
Dog meat is the main ingredient in South Korea's highly prized bosintang soup. The dish, which costs around $10, is made from boiled dog bits mixed with spices like green onions, taro stalk, leeks, ginger, garlic, and perilla, a herb in the mint family that helps disguise the intense smell of cooked dogs.
Oh, I love dogs. That's terrible.
You know, my wife is from a Korean background, and her brother often tells me of his trips to Korea, and it's pretty vicious, man, like what they do for the dog soup, because it's not just a dog off the street. The dog has to be tenderized.
Oh.
So he is telling me for the best tasting kind of dog dishes.
Do I want to hear this?
They have to beat the dog up.
Oh, that's disgusting.
It's not good. But yeah, Koreans have some weird dishes. Have you seen...
Yeah, but they believe that they can die a fan death as well.
That's true. Have you seen the octopus you eat that's so fresh that it's still alive? Like, it's still moving?
No. Oh, yeah, in the pot. I've seen that on YouTube.
Yeah, I told you the story of my brother-in-law when he was trying to eat the octopus. And he said it was like sucking to the outside of his face, and he had to fight to get it into his mouth.
No, you didn't tell me that.
It sounds like great fun.
Oh my God.
So plenty of strange dishes there. We'll link to that in the show notes if you're feeling hungry. Yeah, I think I'll stick to the regular dishes for dinner tonight. That brings us to a close for this Plus episode. Thanks for listening in. Thanks for being a Plus member. We'll catch you mid next week.